The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Ross, Judge Frisch. The Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is May 6, 2021, for our audio recording. We are conducting today's oral arguments by Zoom in accordance with pandemic-related court orders. The same procedural rules apply to our Zoom oral arguments as apply to our in-person oral arguments. Each party will have 15 minutes for their oral argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The first case on our calendar today is A20-0982, State of Minnesota versus Brian Lynn Paxton. I'll ask counsel to identify yourself and the party you represent when you begin your argument. And counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm an attorney from the Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant, Brian Paxton, on his case. This appeal presents two issues to this court. The first deals with whether the district court abused its discretion by admitting prior threats that Mr. Paxton made to a non-victim, his mother. And then the second issue deals with whether the evidence was legally insufficient to support the conviction for unlawful possession of ammunition by a prohibited person. Today, I'm going to primarily address the first argument dealing with the admissibility of the evidence. And then at the end, I'm planning to turn to the sufficiency argument. The court here abused its discretion by admitting the evidence of the prior threats made to Mr. Paxton's mother for two related reasons. The first is that the evidence was not relevant to the relationship between the defendant, Mr. Paxton, in this case, and the victim, Brandon Paxton. Minnesota statute.
Well, why not? I mean, the reason that he even went over to the house was because mom called, because mom was being threatened, or at least allegedly. So why isn't it relevant? I mean, it's certainly probative. It provides context for why the circumstances arose.
Well, I have a couple responses to that. First, the prior threats that were referenced at trial in the testimony, that were introduced in the testimony, went beyond that conversation between Mr. Paxton and his mother that day that came before her call to Brandon Paxton. So, the court did admit evidence of threats beyond the content of that specific phone call. Even assuming that the phone call had some legitimate non-propensity purpose, there was still evidence admitted beyond that concerning previous threats that Mr. Paxton had made to his mother.
But isn't that the point of 634.20 to provide that kind of context?
Well, what the Supreme Court says is, yes, it is appropriate to provide that kind of context, but the context it's providing is for the defendant-victim relationship. The prior incidents illuminate the defendant-victim relationship. They contextualize the defendant-victim relationship. They provide history of the defendant-victim relationship and put the charged offense in that context. Here, this case is different in our view because the threats didn't say anything about Mr. Paxton's relationship with his son. It's talking about his...
But getting back to the statute allows evidence of domestic conduct against the victim or against a family member or household member. So it provides that evidence is admissible unless the probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And the Supreme Court has expressly adopted the statute as a rule of evidence in State v. Fragra. So given that rule of evidence permits evidence of domestic conduct towards another family member. I'm not sure why your argument that it didn't involve the victim is really persuasive here.
I really, with the text of the statute, that's what the text says.
And do you agree that in State v. Fragra, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that the court expressly adopted 634.20 as a rule of evidence in terms of it extending to domestic conduct against a family member or household member? I think the case expressly says that.
That's correct. And the court has adopted the statute as a rule of evidence. But in the decisions that did adopt it, including McCoy, the Supreme Court discussed that the evidence offered under 634.20 is offered to illuminate a specific relationship between the defendant and the victim.
That's only part of it. Or contextualize the circumstances. I mean, help me to understand from an analytical standpoint what you believe the rule is doing, the now adopted rule, the statute adopted as a rule. Am I correct that the rule essentially creates a presumption of relevance? I mean, it's a per se. It's a per se statement that this evidence is admissible unless. Doesn't that presume relevance?
I think that may be correct. That a party won't need to make an independent showing under, the evidence is relevant under 401 if it falls under falls within category, but our principal point, though, is that that statute still has to be read and harmonized with other rules of evidence, and also has to be read consistent with the common law. And both the rules of evidence elsewhere and the common law prohibit propensity evidence. So although the text of the statute says what it says, at the same time, that needs to be read consistently with the general ban on propensity evidence. And if it's a situation where an incident involving another family member or household member that's not the victim, when that has no bearing on the charged offense and no bearing on the relationship between the defendant and the victim, then that evidence in that case could only be used in a propensity way.
That same argument is made consistently and rejected consistently with regard to Spriggle evidence, which is another category of evidence that is offered for a presumed different reason other than character. And its relevance to the case isn't, in the case of Spriggle, not so much bearing on the substance, but bearing upon the propensity of the individual to tell the truth. It gives you context for credibility. And so it's relevant, even though it might have some shades of character evidence. Why wouldn't we treat evidence under 634.20 under the same framing?
Well, we really present two alternative ways the court could approach it. I mean, in our view, if there needs, under the way that the Supreme Court has read 634.20 and construed it, there needs to be some explanation of how this evidence involving a non-victim still illuminates or contextualizes the victim-defendant relationship.
Why doesn't it illuminate the family relationship, and why isn't that relevant here?
Because Mr. Paxton isn't charged with an assault against the family. Generally, he's charged with domestic crimes against his son in particular. So that's the victim that matters as far as whether the evidence is relevant for a legitimate purpose in our view. So it's not enough that it contextualizes the family relationship. It needs to contextualize that particular relationship between Mr. Paxton and his son, because his son's the victim in this case.
If that's so, why would the rule be written the way it's written? If the only relevant domestic evidence is the evidence that bears upon directly the relationship between the victim and the perpetrator. Couldn't the legislature and the Supreme Court in adopting the rule have carved that out if that was really the intent, as opposed to what Judges Frisch and Cochran have focused on, which is contextualizing the family relationship?
They could have written the rule differently, but it's with the way it is written, though, it is consistent with a focus on the defendant-victim relationship. And that's the way that the Supreme Court read the rule in McCoy, and the way that this court's also read the rule that said that the three things that matter for 364, or the three things that need to be common between the current offense and the prior offense, is the defendant, the victim, and a domestic incident involved both things. So you need those three elements to be present. So, I mean, courts have looked at that rule, and they've really tethered it in every case to the defendant-victim relationship. The legislature could have written it differently, but it's also consistent with the way they did write it, that you know, court can admit evidence involving other family members if it says something about the defendant-victim relationship. And you can imagine lots of scenarios where that would be the case. But if we were to take it to the other extreme, interrupted. Yeah.
The McCoy case that you're relying on is a 2004 case, and Fagra is a 2015 case, and Fagra makes clear that evidence of domestic conduct against a family member is admissible under 634.20. And so can you point us to a case post-Fagra that says that the probative, or that supports your position, that there really isn't any probative value unless it illuminates the defendant-victim relationship, that domestic conduct involving another family member?
I cannot, Your Honor. But I would also just say the courts never disavowed the statements made in McCoy and in Meyer about that focus being on the defendant-victim relationship. But no, I can't point to any case after Fraggett that.
So I don't disagree with you that this propensity evidence is potentially prejudicial to your client, but I want you to address two things. The first is that the district court gave multiple cautionary instructions to the jury, including at the time this evidence was introduced, sua sponte, and then also made a determination that the probative value of this evidence was not outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice to your client. So why don't those two things taken together insulate the decision of the district court from this abuse of discretion standard that we're looking at?
Sure. Well, the jury instruction, while the court followed the jury instructions that are set forth, in our view, it doesn't really address the risk, the prejudicial risk in this case, that would be misused as propensity evidence. The jury instruction addresses the risk that the jury would convict Mr. Paxton for the prior threats involving his mother instead of for the charged offense. But the instruction did not address the risk that the jury would generalize from the bad act against his mother the threat that Mr. Paxton is a violent guy or a guy who does bad things to his family members. And that fact makes it more likely that he committed this crime against his son.
That's exactly what the district court told the jury not to do with that evidence. You can't use it as a propensity evidence.
The court didn't say not to use it as propensity evidence. The court said not to use it as evidence that not to convict him based on his prior acts and to
right.
But just respectfully, that's something different than propensity evidence. Propensity is when you generalize character from a prior act and then say that character makes someone more likely to have committed the current offense.
And to be clear, you didn't ask for a different instruction.
No.
Nope. I'm lost at the difference. The hair, I think, that you're trying to split here, that if a district court tells a jury that you cannot rely upon the evidence to convict for this particular conduct, doesn't that cover both the specific relationship between that evidence and the conduct and the more generalized propensity between that evidence and the conduct? Why doesn't the district court's limiting instruction cover the whole field? I don't understand.
Because it specifically only referenced the risk that there'd be a conviction based on the substance of the prior conduct.
Right.
And then there's also a statement the court
made. Conviction based upon the prior conduct. Why doesn't that cover both propensity to commit the act and some more direct relationship a jury might make in a juror's mind?
Well, I mean, because specifically it doesn't address propensity. I mean, propensity in our view is that it's character. It's an inference about broader character made from a specific act, and then that character makes someone more likely to commit a crime. None of that was discussed. I mean, the way that the Supreme Court's formulated propensity in Old Chief, there was nothing approaching that formulation of that type of misuse of the evidence. And it's a real risk that the district court was addressing. That's that the jury is going to look at a prior bad act and say, well, we got to punish the defendant for this bad thing he did in the past. But that's a different problem than what's created by propensity in our view. And that separate problem wasn't specifically addressed by the instruction.
Mr. McLaughlin, thank you for your argument. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. Stephen C. Cundy, Kanawha County Attorney's Office. I'm also present with Mr. Daniel Shoup from our office because of my technological ineptitude. May it please the court, the state believes that Mr. Brandon Paxton and his mother, or grandmother, Ms. Ammerman, are family or household members pursuant to 518B, and that the 634-20 evidence was properly admitted. The court did, in fact, do a balancing test, and the concerns raised by the defendant are that the jury ruled based on the prior acts, but case law holds that when balancing the probative value against the potential prejudice, unfair prejudice is not merely damaging evidence, even severely damaging evidence, rather unfair prejudice that persuades by illegitimate means.
What is the state's view of the mechanical effect of 634-20? Is it that the rule creates a presumption of relevance, or does it do something else? Does it create per se relevance? What is your understanding of the rule?
I believe that it does determine that in trying to gauge the nature of the relationship, because domestic conduct typically takes place outside of the presence of others, that it is particularly helpful to help, as the court knows, to illuminate the nature of the relationship.
Right. No, I understand that. I mean, you're getting into the substance and rationale of the rule. I'm more interested in the legal mechanics of it. Is your understanding that the rule creates a bright line test of per se relevance for other family member conduct, or is it a mere presumption of relevance, or is it something else not having to do with relevance?
I believe that it is a determination for the court that it is relevant, but the court does, in order to preserve the defendant's rights and to help protect against the danger that the information is so bad that the jury would be incapable of evaluating that testimony in light of the conduct alleged, and that to make a determination based on that prior bad act.
So you're agreeing with Mr. McLaughlin that it's a the rule creates a presumption of relevance.
I believe that 63420 allows it, and that the judge has to make a determination whether or not it should be admissible because of the danger of any unfair prejudice.
Let me ask a follow-up, if I may, Judge Ross, just to clarify. When you say the rule allows it, are you saying it? I'm still not clear on whether you're saying there's a presumption or if it's per se admissible. In other words, the rule says evidence of domestic conduct by the accused that meets certain criteria is admissible unless the probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. So when it says it is admissible, does that mean it's per se admissible? And then the role, if it meets those criteria, and then the role of the district court is to balance, once it makes that determination, to balance the probative value and the potential for unfair prejudice? Or is there just a presumption that it's admissible in the district court?
The former, Your Honor. I believe that because it says is admissible unless the probative value.
So you're saying it's per se admissible unless the probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice.
That's the state's understanding, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
May I continue?
Yes. Thank you. Judge Ross, did you have any further questions along those lines?
Okay. I'm sorry.
Please go ahead.
No, I think it's cleared up. I mean, it's a little bit interesting how it works intellectually. I'm thinking that perhaps relevance comes into it only in the prejudice part of the test then, right? So it's presumed to be admissible unless, and here's where relevance comes in, it only comes in once you get to the question of whether there's a substantial outweighing.
I believe that would be a correct assumption, Your Honor. In this particular court case, the court did the requisite balancing test and allowed the testimony. And in this particular case, the information was served two purposes. It did, in fact, illuminate the relationship between Brandon Paxton and his father. It also illuminated the nature of the relationship between his mother. And it also helped with assessing credibility. In this particular case, Mr. Paxton denied any of the wrongdoing in the case. So it became particularly relevant as well for the jury in assessing the credibility of Mr. Paxton. With regard to the bullet, in this particular
Before you turn to the second issue, I'd like to discuss the relationship evidence and the weighing of the probative value versus the potential for unfair prejudice. Is propensity the potential that this evidence could be used as propensity evidence, something that then gets considered in the weighing of the danger of unfair prejudice, in your view?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that's also supported by the case law. The judge has to make a determination that if the evidence were admitted, would it persuade the jury by illegitimate means? Specifically, that would that evidence, would that testimony cause the jury to improperly conclude that the defendant had the propensity to act this way on this particular occasion? And that is part of the balancing test that the court must engage in making the determination whether or not the testimony should come in.
And does the jury instruction weigh into that weighing?
I believe it does, Your Honor. The judge did give instructions to the jury. He also gave advisories prior to the taking of the testimony. And the case law holds that the courts presume that the jurors follow a judge's instructions. And that is the purpose of the limiting instruction, is to lessen the probability that the jury will convict by unfair means.
Tell me if you agree with my analytical understanding of the rule, which is that the way it works is that the rule essentially presumes relevance, but it also presumes some degree of danger and propensity. And both of those things, propensity and relevance, are considered only in the second stage after you presumptively admit the evidence.
I would tend to agree to you, Honor. And the case law again holds that the testimony can be damaging, even severely damaging, but that doesn't mean it isn't relevant. And it's up to the court to do that balancing test. And that is what took place in this particular case. And I believe that the court made the proper decision in allowing the testimony to come in. And as was previously referenced too, with regard to Ms. Ammerman, a large part of the testimony that she gave was for why she called her grandson and had him come over. And I don't believe that that would necessarily be considered 634-20 relationship evidence, but it was for why she called her grandson and what took place. She did provide testimony about the nature of her relationship and about her grandson's relationship with him, and that is the subject of 634-20.
You were going to say something, I think, a moment ago. You were going to segue over to the sufficiency of the evidence, and I did have you a question about that. How can a police officer confuse a 380 round with a 357 Magnum round? You would agree, wouldn't you, that these are, I mean, some bullets look similar to each other, but these are physically obviously different.
I think that disparity, Your Honor, points to the fact that it is a mistake. I'm a gun guy. A 375 H&H is an extremely large rifle caliber bullet. A 380 is essentially a 9mm short. Actual cartridge was a pistol cartridge, but with regard to this, I think that only goes to show that this was a mistake. And the testimony obtained from the officers is that they found the bullet, they bagged it at that time, sealed it, marked it, and that was in fact that bullet. There was also testimony that our controls, so that there couldn't have been a different bullet. The officers testified they were certain that was the bullet, and there's no way it could have been a different bullet.
And there's am I correct that the testimony doesn't question the physical chain, that there is sufficient testimony to show that that there wasn't a break in the physical passing of the bullet from the officer to the baggie, to the analysis, back to the baggie, and then to court?
In the course of the trial, there was some discussion about that and whether there was a break. And there was questioning about whether it was possible that the bullet in question was, in fact, the bullet that was located. And was it perhaps possible that a different bullet located on that night could have been placed in the evidence bag, to which both officers responded in the negative. That because the bag was sealed with the case number and it was done in the presence of both of the officers that testified, that there was no possibility that that could have occurred. And the state would point out that the argument in some senses comes down to a credibility argument on the part of whether the officer's testimony was reasonable. And according to case law, that is not the appellate court's function. Appellate courts defer to the fact finder's credibility determinations, and it is not the role on appeal to reweigh the evidence to reassess witness credibility.
So we're clear, was it a 375 or a 357 that actually was in the bag?
357.
So the other argument that they make is that under 60902 subdivision 17, there was no evidence at trial that the bullet was operable. When I read subdivision 17, I'm not entirely sure that you're required to prove that a bullet is operable. What is the state's position on the construction of that subdivision?
I think it needs to be rewritten because I think it is somewhat ambiguous.
Well, rewriting it is not our job. We're not going to rewrite the statute.
I agree. But again, as I said, I'm a gun guy. I reload ammunition. And it talks about components and parts. And that I think what the legislative intent was that individual components on their own that could be used to construct ammunition or defective ones were not applicable. I do think the legislative intent was that a cartridge would constitute ammunition. And with regard to whether or not the state proved, because of that
ambiguity. Well, what is it that you believe the state has to prove about the bullet for it to constitute ammunition? I mean, when I look at subdivision 17, it reads ammunition means ammunition or cartridge cases, primers, bullets, or propelled powder. So does the state even need to do anything to, you know, other than introduce a bullet to establish that it's ammunition?
I do not believe so. But again, I don't agree with the statute the way it's written, because I think the last words that are not operable as ammunition, a primer by itself would not constitute an operable firearm. Neither would a cartridge case on its own.
Neither would powder.
Pardon?
Neither would powder.
Correct. And
I mean, but the second clause of the statute states what ammunition does not include, and that would be ornaments, curiosities, souvenirs constructed from or resembling ammunition or ammunition components that are not operable as ammunition. The exhibit that was introduced at trial is none of those things, correct?
It is according to the testimony of Sergeant Fine, it was a live round, given that the projectile was intact in the shell casing and that the primer, which is the bottom portion of the cartridge, what needs to be struck by the hammer in order to ignite the powder, was intact. And if
there was no dimple in the firing pin, I take it?
Correct.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for your answers to those questions. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal now.
Mr. McLaughlin, can we start where we left off, and that is the construction of subdivision 17? How is it that the introduction of the bullet, as described in the testimony, does not constitute ammunition within the meaning of the first clause of subdivision 17?
A couple of responses to that. I mean, our first position would be that ammunition components encompasses bullets.
How is that possible when the first clause says what ammunition is and it states that ammunition means bullets? I'm not understanding the construction that you're advocating here in light of the language in the statute.
I mean,
Sure. Let me ask it a slightly different way, just so I understand the big picture. Does your sufficiency of the evidence argument depend on there having been a different bullet in your or different item in your client's pocket than was at trial? Do you concede, I guess, for the purpose of Judge Frisch's question, that the thing that was introduced at trial, that particular bullet, meets the definition under the statute?
Yes. Our argument is that the evidence is legally insufficient because the state did not prove that was the same bullet that was possessed.
So your inoperable, your inoperability argument goes to your position that what was actually in your client's pocket at the time of arrest was an inoperable something, but wasn't a fireable, unspent bullet.
So there was, I mean, the argument, there's no evidence that whatever was found in his pocket was an operable bullet. The only evidence was that the trial bullet was operable. So then the state would need to establish that same bullet was the one that was possessed by Mr. Paxton. I understand.
Mr. McLaughlin, but doesn't your argument also basically require us to reweigh the evidence? I mean, you could just answer that and then I'll follow
up. Yeah, I mean, I understand respondent's position. Even accepting the officers, even without making a credibility determination, there still were two separate errors made at the time of arrest. You know, that it was one characterizing it as a 375 bullet, one characterizing it as a 380. An error that was made both in writing and orally in a recording. Even accepting the officer's testimony is true regarding that they followed the proper procedures with chain of custody, there's still this basic inconsistency between what was reportedly observed at the time of his arrest and what was produced at trial.
Well, you say what was produced at trial. There was different. The testimony of the officers conflicted with their written statements, but didn't the testimony at trial correct any of those errors so that if you believe the testimony at trial, there was a sufficient chain of custody?
The testimony at trial offered an explanation for why the errors occurred.
Didn't the jury accept the testimony that it was a mistake? Would you acknowledge that?
Yeah, we'd acknowledge that. But there also was a testimony introduced at trial that what they initially reported was something different, and the jury could also consider that evidence alongside the officer's explanation that it was a mistake. So,
and they did, apparently, and they resolved the conflict. They're satisfied that one officer didn't know the difference between a 380 and a 357, and the other one simply transposed the last two numbers and meant to describe a 357, which, by the way, looks very different from a 375.
And the jury, the jury did, you know, find him guilty of the offense. I guess where our view that isn't really doesn't require resolving a credibility determination. It's not a credibility determination. It was more which parts of evidence the jury used to support the verdict.
Well, what are you asking us to do? Are you asking us to say that the officer's testimony was so incredible that we can reverse the jury's determination relying upon it?
We ask that the court look at what the officers reported both at the time of the arrest and then compared to it, what was reported at the time of trial, and considering all the evidence together, that doesn't meet a reasonable standard beyond a reasonable doubt. We believe there's a way to get there without making a credibility determination, but understand if the court views it differently. So if I could very briefly just get back to the first argument, I do think the court could resolve this case under analysis of the second part of the statute, you know, that the probative value was outweighed by the risk of prejudice. And really, that would be a way that could incorporate what we were arguing earlier about how this evidence is really meant to illuminate the defendant-victim relationship and leave room for a case such as this where the prior incident or the prior threat concerned a different relationship, but that's going to have only marginal probative value. And it's much more likely to be misused as prejudice. So that's an alternative way this court could go on it and would be consistent with the ban on propensity evidence. And it would allow situations where the statute isn't applied in a way that opens the door to sort of unlimited introduction of propensity evidence.
All right. Thank you both for your arguments today and your helpful answers to our questions. We will take the case under advisement and issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.